Thank you, Susan and Tyler, for leading us beautifully again this Sunday morning. The wind howled outside in the darkness, and the torrents of swirling rain came left and right and up and down against the group that walked across the courtyard. Once inside, they huddled beside the burning logs of a fireplace in Southwick House, just outside Portsmouth, to hear a Scottish weather captain give his forecast for the next day's weather. On the basis of this forecast, Eisenhower would make an ultimate decision. He would have to decide whether he was going to give the green light to the largest seaborne invasion in history the next day, where 3 million soldiers and troops had gathered in the southern part of England, and whether they should be launched into an attack against Hitler's Atlantic Wall. They gathered together, huddling and listening to the captain's forecast, and Stagg said that there was a marginal clearing, a gleam of hope. For the next day, the next 24 to 36 hours, the ceiling of the sky would be over the beaches of France and Normandy, about 3,000 feet. The waves would be about 3 feet in height. And they had to make a decision to go the next day, to take the risk and the gamble, and perhaps have miscalculated, and that would have been catastrophic and would have led to large casualties and maybe one of the greatest defeats ever. Or to wait, to hang back another month and to delay going that day and to wait for the moon and for the tides to align again. According to the records of that moment, they were quiet, and Eisenhower thought and thought for what seemed to be an eternal silence of somewhere between 35 to 45 seconds. And then he responded with three words, "Okay, we'll go." And that was a pivotal moment, an ultimate decision that changed the course of the Second World War. D-Day. The Christian life is not a sprint. It is a marathon. The Christian life is one of enduring. It's one of running the race, staying on the track, staying the course. The Christian life is about pressing on. Turn in your Bibles, if you would, to Joshua chapter 1 this morning, and we'll read the first 9 verses of this book. Joshua 1, 1 through 9. Now it came about after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' servant, saying, "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, cross this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, to the sons of Israel. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I have given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, even as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and as far as the great sea toward the setting of the sun, will be your territory. No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous. For you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. The first word in the Hebrew text of Joshua is a curious word. It's a word that is a conjunction. It's really the word and. And when you have that conjunction and, which is somewhat unique, joining Deuteronomy and Joshua, that word and straddles these two books. That and reaches back to what precedes retrospect. It reaches forward to what proceeds prospect. To go back in retrospect, as we open up this theater, this scene in Joshua, we reach back to what was before that and, the time of the patriarchs, the time of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, of Joseph, of the Exodus, of Moses, and now Moses' death. And here comes the word in the opening scene. Now the one who has been with them, Moses, has departed and gone. Joshua is now given the command, the mantle of leadership to press on. In a sense, today, we come to the lives that we live in this COVID world, and we have to, amidst the weariness of this exhaustion of living in isolation and cut off from people and social distancing and of losing family and friends and loved ones, the temptation is to give in, to give up, and to just throw in the towel. But the word comes to us today in this difficult day to press on, to keep going. Life's landscape will change. Change is a reality, and right now we're in a change that none of us could have predicted or in any way anticipated. But it's a fact of life. And so the option is to stay back or to drop out or to press on and to go forward in the confidence that God will give us the strength for this day in our generation. 3 points. As I look at this text, I see first that we need to latch the gate on the past. We need to latch the gate on the past. The opening chapter of Joshua is filled with sobering gravitas. 5 words echo through this opening scene. And by the way, this opening scene is, as one has described it, fraught with background. Moses, my servant, is dead. Moses, the one who floated as a tiny little baby boy in that ark on that River Nile, lodged and hidden between the papyrus reeds, of that crocodile-infested delta. Moses, the young man who was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter and schooled and tutored in the finest civilization of the world, educated, eating with opulence and being given the privileges of regality and royalty and being the prince of Egypt. Moses, the one who becomes the fugitive, the exile, who meanders literally in his life course for 40 years as he wanders around looking after the sheep of Jethro, his father-in-law. Moses, the one who comes to Pharaoh, and there begins the clash of the titans, the Egyptian god Pharaoh against Jehovah, Moses' God, the duel of the 10 plagues. Before Moses is given the sanction of taking the people, the Hebrew serfs, out through a spliced Red Sea, there God builds a land bridge, and the people leave the womb of oppression for freedom. Moses, who stands in awe and fear atop Mount Sinai as God comes amidst the smoke, the noise, the shaking of the mountain, and with finger gives to Moses the 10 words, the Decalogue. Moses, who leads after the spy report which prevailed, the naysayers that won the day. Moses, who leads the people in a trek to the grave until that wilderness generation has dropped into the desert sands. The Moses who has brought the people to the brink of the Jordan River. The Moses who has been the one drawn out of the Nile, the son of the bulrushes, the one who has lived for 120 years, is now dead. It must have been to that nation, to that new generation, as if the sun had been shadowed in eclipse. It must have been to that generation as though the stars had fallen out of their place. Moses was gone. Some of you may have read of what happened on the day that Franklin Delano Roosevelt passed away on the 12th of April in Warm Springs, Georgia, on that day in April of 1945. How the world was stunned. In my day, it would be the assassination of Kennedy. Every one of us remembers where we were that day. But the records of what transpired when the news came through on those crackling radios on that 12th of April, 1945, when the Second World War was still going on, I've read of accounts of a barber who was shaving in Cleveland, Ohio, who, hearing those words, put his razor down and sat and looked with a vacant stare into the distance for 10 minutes without saying a word. Of pool players in Omaha, Nebraska, who were plying away the time, whiling away the time, hearing on the radio of Roosevelt's death, put up their pool stakes and walked out into the street without saying a word. Of taxis in Manhattan, in New York, pulling to the curbside when they heard the news and just sitting transfixed. Of Churchill hearing at midnight of Roosevelt's passing, sitting up in bed and being absolutely mum, pale, white, and just sitting there hearing the news, stunned. Of Chiang Kai-shek, who, on hearing the news of Roosevelt's passing, went into 24 hours of meditation. The world was stunned by the death of Roosevelt and Kennedy. Just in the same way, the Hebrew nation was stunned by the death of this one called Moses. Moses, the prophet. Moses, the liberator. Moses, the lawgiver. Moses the judge, Moses the commander. Now, as we read this text, we see the narrative tension in this first chapter of Joshua. There are questions now that abound in the vacuum of the change in leadership. Will this one, Joshua, the son of Nun, be like a new Moses? Is this one, Joshua, qualified to take over the mantle and to fill the big shoes of Moses? Will this one be faithful, this Joshua, as Moses was? So this text breathes with pathos. It breathes with anxiety. There's a tension as there's a change in leadership. Joshua had been the apprentice. He had been the adjutant. He had been the second lieutenant who had been schooled for 40 years under the wings of Moses. And now it's his turn. Some of you sit here today as you watch, and welcome to you. And your lives have perhaps changed irrevocably over these past months. Perhaps there have been people who've populated the landscape of your life, and they're gone. A faithful partner in life. Perhaps a business associate, maybe even a friend who you leaned on for fellowship and strength, gone, like the Hebrew slaves. There's this void. There's this sense of being bereft, orphaned in this moment, in this text. Will this one who is Moses, who took the nation to the brink of the promised land, find security now in this new leader? There's a key principle in this first point. The key principle of latching the gate on the past. The past is the past. We have to put our backs to the past. We cannot take shelter in the past. We have to turn the pages of our lives. Life cannot exist in the past. We cannot linger in the shadows or wallow in the shadows or live in the shadows of the yesterdays. It is Joshuan and Pauline to forget what lies behind and to press on, as Philippians 3 exhorts us through Paul's writings, to press on to what lies ahead. So, my friends, if you are looking at your past and you see the past days through jaded and jaundiced eyes, make a funeral pyre of your past failures that haunt you. Pour gasoline on that funeral pyre of past failures and set it alight and bury the ashes. We are forgiven. We are new creations in Christ Jesus. And we can move on. Latch the gate on the past. Second point, as I look at this text, I see too that we are to lodge in the place of God's now. Notice how verse 2 comes out with these sobering, staggering, stunning words: Moses, my servant, is dead. That phrase, my servant, is a loving tribute to a great man. He is not brushed aside. He's recognized for whom he was. My servant Moses. That phrase, my servant, is used 18 times of Moses in the Pentateuch. Moses, the servant of God. It's used twice of Joshua. That speaks volumes. But when we come to this verse 2, after we've heard those stunning words, "Moses, my servant, is dead," notice the command that now comes. "Now, Joshua, therefore arise, cross this Jordan, you and all this people." God comes and he speaks a new word to a new leader in a new day. Remember that Moses and Joshua's come and go. Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that Joshua was 40 years old when Moses came back to do that duel with Pharaoh. So Joshua would have been about 85 years old now when he inherits this leadership of this people. And we can see that he must have traveled with seeds of disappointment, and there must have been times when he would have wanted to pitch it in and throw in the towel, no doubt. For Joshua and Caleb had come back with a spy report that had talked about the greatness of Jehovah that dwarfed the giants, the Anakim, and they should go in and take the land. But we know that the majority report that said the giants were too big and their God was too small prevailed. The naysayers of that day won. The doubters won the day. The naysayers triumphed. And Joshua and Caleb and Moses had to continue to walk and walk to press on in the midst of huge disappointment and dissatisfaction. They had to continue to be faithful, tenacious, persevering, pressing on through those 38 more years. Robert Falcon Scott led the second polar expedition. And in October, he left with 11 men to make his way to find the South Pole. He left with sled dogs and with ponies. And Scott and his party made their way across this frozen wasteland without any real maps. And 7 of those men with the dogs turned back and went back home to the base. But 4 of the men plus Scott continued to go on towards that South Pole, running out of food, incredibly complicated and catastrophic weather. The weather was atrocious. The frostbite that began to set in, and even running out of food where they had to shoot the ponies in order to survive. Well, they came to that South Pole, and as many of you know, they found with huge disappointment that a Norwegian by the name of Roald Amundsen had beaten them to the South Pole by 1 month. They got there on January the 17th, Scott and his 4 men. January the 17th, 1912. They turned around and they began to walk back towards their base, miles away. Many of us know the story of how these 4 men plus Scott lost their lives. But they began to continue to press and to press and to trudge as far as they could go. Edgar Evans was the first of the 5 to succumb to frostbite and to perish in that snow of Antarctica on the 17th of February, 1912. Well, it was actually, February the 17th. About a month later, in March, one of the men by the name of Lawrence Oates, in these immortal lines, said as he went outside, he was suffering from frostbite. He left the tent with these words, "I'm just going outside, and maybe for some time." He was leaving. He was going out into the blizzard and into the snow so that the other 3 would have what was left. Well, there was Barrow, there was Bowers, and there was Wilson, and there was Scott. And they, the last entry that we've got in Robert Falcon Scott's journal was found by a young Norwegian who actually found the bodies of the three in a tent. But the last entry of Robert Falcon Scott before he succumbed to the blizzard in the tent in the freezing climate of that day was this entry, and I read it. "We shall stick it out to the end. But we are getting weaker, of course, and the end cannot be far. It seems a pity, but I do not think I can write more." The bodies of Scott and of Bowers and Wilson were found on the 12th of November of that same year, some 7 or 8 months after they had, Scott and his two men had expired. This young Norwegian that found them, by the name, the last name of Gran, took his own skis and he made a cross over the place where they had found these three men and where they had buried them. And then he writes in a later journal, Gran writes that he took Scott's skis and he writes these words, "I'm using the owner's skis," i.e. Scott's skis. "They must finish the journey, and they will. Press on. We must finish the journey, and with God's strength, we will." There's a kind of myth, a legend, a fairy tale out there that great families, great businesses, great churches can be built by just living out the normalcy of our lives. That's not fair. That's not true. You will not travel through life with normalcy. There will come sooner than later into your life and into my life the demand to walk into the teeth of the wind, to walk into the steepest of deepest of valleys, to climb the steepest of crags and mountains. We must press on in the midst of that journey. If you look at the verse here that I am reading out of verse 2 here, "Now therefore arise, cross this Jordan, you Joshua, you singular, not you among the crowd, Joshua, not you, a forest of trees, Joshua, a sea of waves, Joshua, you, singular, no place for Joshua to hide." He is called out now to arise. There's an immediacy. There's an urgency here. Joshua, get moving. Joshua, this Jordan must be crossed. They'd come to the edge of the river, looking over the limestone ridge, the rim, across to what was to be Canaan, the promised land. That previous wilderness generation whose bodies were pressed underneath the sands of Egypt in the wilderness. This generation whose faces as they look across was etched with anxiety. And Joshua was to take them through this Jordan River, which if you read chapter 3, verse 15, was in spate, in flood. This Jordan River that ran through the deepest valley on the earth into the Dead Sea at 1,286 feet below sea level. Cross this Jordan. Think about it. This people who had spent centuries in Egypt doing the two-step and the brick vats. This people, this wilderness generation who had wandered around in circles and died off. They had no bridges. They had no boats. They were a desert people. And God says to them, follow Joshua. Walk into the damp riverbed and into the waters and trust me. this Jordan. Where's your Jordan this morning? What river metaphorically are you facing right now that you need to cross? Is it one of a vocation? Stepping out into a new field? Is it one of relational? A relationship where you need to cross the Jordan? Is it one that is perhaps physical? The struggles that you're having physically and the need to cross over in trust into the promised land. How do you find the strength to press on? Safety is found in lodging in God's now. God's presence with you and with me as we walk into each day. Well, the third point that I leave with you is, let's repeat them, latch the gate on the past, lodge in the place of God's now, and finally, lean into the gift of God's morrow. Lead into the gift of God's morrow. Tomorrow. Verse 3. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I have given it to you. He spoke of the future as though it has already passed. That's how certain the promise was that was given to Joshua. This reassured this young new lieutenant and general. This was reminding Joshua that the promised land was theirs. Walk into it, Joshua, with the people. And every sole of the feet of these people will claim that land. The people didn't deserve it. This is not as a consequence of merit. They'd been whiners. They'd been whingers. They had disappointed God time after time. They were a recalcitrant people. They did not have the power to conquer the promised land or to keep it without God's presence. But God says, travel out and trust with me, and I will give you the future. I will give you the cities of Canaan. And we'll start off with this military tactics, which will have the people in Jericho scratching their heads. Walk around those stout walls of Jericho once each day for 6 days. Take those seven priests with the shofar, the trumpets, and let the ark come behind them. And then on that seventh day, march around seven times, and then have those seven priests blow the shofar, and the people shout in unison, and the walls will crumble. Go into Joshua chapter 10. When you fight the Amorites, I will extend the day. I will hold back the day to give you length of battle and stop the moon. The military tactics were different, but God was there in place, showing them that He was ultimately the warrior fighting for them and with them. God binds Himself to the people. How do I press on? By knowing that I'm walking into the presence of God's now, that I don't walk alone, that God goes with me. His promises do not change. He gave to Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 24, the promise that they would take the land. That promise is reiterated and replicated, repeated to Joshua in Joshua chapter 1, verse 4. That promise is later replicated again by Caleb, who goes back to Moses' promise to him to take the land of Hebron. Continuity. Put your foot on the land, and I will give it to you. In fact, I already have given it to you. What surety is that? Harold Lamb wrote a biography on Alexander the Great. And he writes in this biography how this Macedonian young pup at 20 years old consolidated the Greek city-states and then set his eyes eastwards towards the common enemy, Persia, Darius III. And as he went through and carried the maps of that day, they went as far east as Asia Minor. And after Asia Minor, there was just blank space on the maps. And we know that Alexander the Great went beyond into that blank space. He went further east to the Himalayan mountains, to the Indus River in India. He walked right off the map, marched off the map. God often comes and he asks us to do that, to walk off the map in trust with him, to journey out with confidence, not in ourselves, but in the fact that he will be with us through the circumstances of our lives. Isn't that what Jesus said to his disciples? Go out from Jerusalem, Judea, Galilee, Samaria, to the uttermost parts of the world. March off the map with me. Where's the destination in your life right now? Where is God asking you not only to cross the River Jordan, but where is he wanting to take you, spiritually speaking? Where's the home? Where's the destination? Where's the right place that God has centered for you in your life and in other people's lives? So hang your life on me. That's what I read in this text. Joshua, hang your life on me. I've given you the promise of presence, of victory, of invincibility. Look at verse 5. Until the work is done, no one will stand before you. That doesn't mean there will not be immunities. Doesn't mean there will be hard battles. They went in with overconfidence against Ai after Jericho with 2,000 or 3,000 men. And Achan had violated the ban. He'd taken the mantle of Shinar, silver shekels, 200, and a gold bar of 50 shekels. And he was found out. He'd compromised the victory in that little town of Ai. There will not be automatic victories in our struggle and our spiritual lives. There will be times when we will fail. There will be times when we will be scarred. But there's the ultimate promise that you may lose a battle, but you will win the war. I will be with you in the journey. I will not fail you. Look at verse 5. I will not fail you or forsake you. That means you will not sink. I will not let you sink. I will not let you down. I will not relax my grasp on you. I will not abandon you. This is a powerful word in the Hebrew text. I will not drop you in the middle of the project of inhabiting the promised land. The command ushers in danger and risk. Take the steps into the Jordan River, and the waters will open up like they did in the Red Sea. Cross over with me into this unfamiliar territory, and I promise to be with you. Presence. Be strong and of good courage. Three times. Verse 6, verse 7, and verse 9. That's the rallying cry of the Holy War Project. There will be grave dangers. There will be bloody battles as Canaan is taken through military actions. But keep pressing on. Many of you know Amelia Earhart. She died just weeks before her 40th birthday. But this plucky woman decided that she would circumnavigate the world in solo flight. We know she missed that island atoll in the Pacific Ocean. But she made a statement which I think connects with what we've been talking about this morning. She says, everyone has oceans to fly as long as you have the heart to do it. Everyone has oceans to fly as long as you have the heart to do it. Is it reckless? She asks. Maybe. But what do dreams, she says, know of boundaries? What do dreams know of boundaries? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you, where you are right now, he is with you, wherever you go. Press on.